case is Walter Vega versus Fred Cayley and the Honorable Francis Lynn Gerald. Jordan Satterthwaite and Brandon Breslow. And it looks like the appellant has reserved 5 minutes. And once you're set up, you may proceed.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Cecilia Satterthwaite. Together with my co-counsel, we represent plaintiff appellant Walter Vega. We're here today because Mr. Vega filed a complaint with the district court and paid the filing fee. And the district court acted in a vacuum without any involvement of the defendant or the plaintiff to sua sponte dismiss Mr. Vega's complaint without meaningful leave to amend. This is reversible error for two reasons. First, there are procedural safeguards mandated by this court's precedent that are required when dismissing a fee paid complaint sua sponte. And second, there is no binding authority from this court allowing a sua sponte dismissal for fee paid complaints on frivolity grounds.
You don't think that Sertain is binding precedent on that point? I mean, we've said three times something directly contrary to what you just said. I'll go through them quickly. In Tazo, we said, quote, a district court must generally provide the plaintiff with notice of intent to dismiss or opportunity to respond. There is an exception to our general rule against dismissal without notice if the complaint is patently frivolous or reversal would be futile. In Byrne, footnote 99, we said, even if the parties did not know that the court was considering the sufficiency, we could still find that the court properly treated the claims as if a ruling on Rule 12C motion, because reversal of a sua sponte dismissal without notice may not be mandated if amendment of the complaint would be futile or if it would be patently obvious that the plaintiff could not prevail. And then in Sertan, we said that there was an exception to the general requirement when amending the complaint would be futile or when the complaint is patently frivolous. So, why is that not the law?
If I could take them backwards.
We'll start with Sertain.
Okay.
Yeah.
In Sertain, the court actually gave that litigant two opportunities to amend and repair the deficiencies in the pleading before it did dismiss the retaliation claim.
But don't you have a situation here where Mr. Vega has been repeatedly filing the same claim, and so he is certainly on notice that this is that these claims are frivolous?
This is the fourth 1983 action.
Sure. Respectfully, Your Honors, and thank you to Amicus for outlining it, but each time Mr. Vega does make slightly different allegations against slightly different defendants.
That's true of an amendment. That's always true of an amendment, right? That's always going to be a little different.
Of course. And in this situation, if proper procedures had been followed and Mr. Vega had been given the option to amend, he could have fleshed out two allegations that were actually ignored by the district court in this situation.
How?
On appendix page 10 and appendix page 13, Mr. Vega does allege that from June 19, 2019 to the current day, which was the date of his complaint, he had been facing harassment from the Sheriff's Department. And so that brings it out of the statute of limitations time bar that the district court found, and that harassment claim does not depend on reversal of his conviction. And so if this district court had follow proper procedures, Mr. Vega could have fleshed out those allegations, which were added from the last time he filed his 1983 complaint, or under the line of cases Byrne, Tazo, and Sertain, which all stem from Byrne essentially was taken from the First Circuit and acknowledged that caution needs to be followed. And
we relatedly, though, Mr. Vega's complaint was dismissed because it was patently frivolous, but he has not challenged that on appeal, correct?
Correct. We're not.
Or futility.
We are not saying that Mr. Vega's complaint did not leave something to be desired. What we're saying is, under this court's binding precedent in Jefferson, proper procedures have to be followed in this situation.
I know, but I've just read to you three cases, and Sertain is a holding, as far as I'm concerned, because at least with one claim in Sertain, we said that it was frivolous and amendment would be futile. So we have held that there is allowed sua sponte without notice where a complaint is patently frivolous and where amendment would be futile, have we not?
Well, in Sertain, the litigant was given two opportunities to amend.
No, the litigant did amend, but the point of the dismissal wasn't based on the earlier amendment. In other words, we would have said because he already had two opportunities to amend, it's okay to do it here without notice. That's not what we said. What we said was the general rule is notice, But there's an exception, and the exception applies in that case, where it's patently frivolous or where a further amendment would be futile, right?
That case is inapplicable because he was given an opportunity to...
I know, but that, you're right that that fact exists, mm-hmm. but that doesn't... Every fact that exists... Like, the decision was made on a Tuesday, and today is a Monday, so does that change? I mean, there's all sorts of facts that exist. The question is whether it is a material fact for the holding and reasoning of the case. And there, we didn't use that as a basis for a holding or reasoning. What we said simply was that the complaint was frivolous and futile. And as Judge Brands just mentioned to you, there is no appeal on futility or on frivolousness. It's agreed. The only question is procedure. And I just don't see how we haven't held that the procedure that you're advocating for is not necessary or required.
Well, this court has acknowledged twice, in unpublished opinions admittedly, but has acknowledged twice that there is no binding precedent finding this. And so, specifically in Sertain, the claim that was dismissed, because most of the claims were allowed to go forward even upon the...
Because they weren't frivolous.
Well, the claim that was dismissed as frivolous was, the court specifically noted, it is not at all clear that the litigant even alleges a separate retaliation claim under the FMLA apart from her interference claim. We addressed this claim out of an abundance of caution. So that claim, which was found to be patently frivolous, the court admitted it didn't even know if she was intending to allege it. It was addressed out of an abundance of caution. Similarly, in Tazo, the court specifically found that the complaint was not frivolous and only mentioned the...
I think Taz is probably dicta. That portion is dicta. But I think Sertain is not. Let's assume for the moment I don't read Sertain quite as you do. I think it is a holding on that issue. So then you'd have to show an earlier precedent in time. Now, you point to a few... But the problem is those have the same problem that you just pointed out in Tazo. In those cases, there wasn't a dismissal for frivolousness or for futility. There was a dismissal on the merits or for other reasons.
Sure, but in Jefferson, it specifically highlighted the importance of one opportunity to amend, especially given that Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 15A allows an amendment of the an automatic amendment of the complaint to overcome.
Yeah, but here in this case, as we've talked about, he has been filing multiple 1983 actions, and he has been repeatedly informed that his claims are time barred or barred by HECT. So why in this circumstance is he entitled to notice and an opportunity to be heard?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, Your Honor, there are allegations in his complaint that were not analyzed or addressed by the district court. And if proper procedure had been followed, either by notice and an opportunity to amend or under what Amicus asked for, which is to follow other circuits which have a higher standard that the district court must meet, under either situation, that those allegations would be addressed.
Can I go back to Jefferson for a second?
Sure.
So Jefferson, A, the district court dismissed Jefferson, quote, with prejudice on the merits, that's at page 525, and then the court there said, quote, the case, this is describing Jefferson, the case at hand is one of first impression, for neither the Fifth nor the Eleventh Circuit has ruled on a case where the trial court sua sponte dismissed an action with prejudice because the claim lacked merit. We certainly said other things there, and you point to those other things, and those other things are interesting, but it is not a holding for what the rules are where a claim is frivolous or futile, right? It can't be. Right.
It makes a strong suggestion that proper procedures must be followed.
There's no doubt that's the case, but you agree with me that it can't be a holding on that issue.
Agreed, but in Martinez versus Christie Cleaners in 2004, which is a published decision, the court said that if the district court finds the litigant's complaint is frivolous, it should provide the litigant with the opportunity to amend her complaint before dismissing the action.
Okay, Martinez is interesting. You're right. The quote you just made is right, although I think you missed a little bit of the quote. But there, that was in the remand instructions. In other words, we didn't set out the rule that if a court is going to, meaning a court in general, is going to do this, then it must do this. What we said is in that case, we don't know what happened. So there's two things that could have happened. It could have been done on the financial affidavit, mm-hmm. and if that's the case, then do one thing. Or it could have been that this whole thing was frivolous, in which case do this other thing. But that isn't an instruction that in all cases where it's frivolous, you must do this, right?
It's not an instruction for all cases, but it clearly says that the district court, if finds it frivolous, should give an opportunity to amend.
But not the district courts must do that if it finds a complaint frivolous. It's only in that case because we didn't know up front, here's the procedure you should follow. And I guess my question is, could that be a holding that in all cases where there's a frivolous finding, a district court must do X, Y, and Z?
Proper procedure should be followed in all cases where a fee paid litigant, sua sponte, or pro se litigant files a complaint.
Can you answer my question? Is Martinez a holding for that proposition that if a complaint in general is frivolous, then X, Y, and Z must happen?
Again, it's a strong suggestion.
Okay. So if we just have suggestions on the one hand and a holding in Sertan on the other, then aren't we bound by Sertan?
I respectfully disagree with you that Sertan is a holding on this situation, on binding Mr. Vega's complaint. And again, this court has acknowledged in several unpublished decisions after Sertan came out that this court has not held in a published opinion that district courts have the inherent authority to dismiss frivolous fee paid complaints sua sponte. That's in Wilkerson versus Georgia. In 2017, Smith versus HSBC Bank said,
There's no doubt in unpublished cases we've said what you've said. There's no doubt about that.
Sure. So if this panel acknowledges in unpublished cases, of course, that Sertan is not a binding holding about fee-paid frivolous complaints, likely because that litigant had multiple opportunities to amend and the claim that was dismissed, the court was not even sure she'd alleged it. In those situations, that holding, Sertan, would not be binding on Mr. Vega. And so we are asking this court for clarity. We recognize that the district court in Ailman versus SunTrust Bank in 2018 acknowledged this confusion between the line of cases from Burantazzo and Sertan versus the Jefferson and Martinez cases. And so we're asking for a on-point published decision from this court on this issue so that we can resolve the confusion in the future.
Can I ask you a question? Do you agree or disagree that a district court could have issued an order to show cause asking your client to indicate or respond why the complaint should not be dismissed for frivolity?
We agree that would be an example of a proper procedure that would allow him an opportunity, notice and an opportunity to respond. So yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Breslow?
May it please the court, Brandon Breslow of Kynes, Markman, and Feldman, together with Kristen Norse as court-appointed amicus. This appeal presents the question of whether a district court has the inherent authority to dismiss patently frivolous claims without advance notice to the plaintiff, and we submit that answer is yes, and if the court agrees, it should affirm the judgment below. Now, I want to start very briefly by talking about the fact that as going to Judge Lagoa's last question about the ability to issue an order to show cause as to this. Based on the briefing and the arguments presented today, there seems to be no serious dispute that there is an inherent authority for a district court to dismiss patently frivolous claims whether or not there's a filing fee that's been paid. So I want to focus the rest of my time on the advance notice issue that's been argued by the parties. And I want to unbox that a little bit because as Judge Luck has pointed out, we do believe that Tazo sets out a rule here that the court does not have to give notice when it is dismissing a patently frivolous.
But counsel, if we just had Tazo, Tazo doesn't seem to be a holding on that issue.
I apologize, Sertan.
Okay.
Sertan, yes. Sertan does set that holding out.
What about the distinguishing factor, though, your opposing counsel has raised? Your opposing counsel has said that it is a material distinguishing fact between that case and this case, that there were, in fact, prior amendments, and where that's the case, that takes it outside of the no notice ever given to opposing counsel or opposing party, dismissal right away without any sort of procedure at all.
And that's where it's important to trace back the rule, Your Honor, from Sertain. I mean, the reason we start with Tazo in our briefing and even before that in Byrne is because there is this legal landscape preceding Sertain as to why the court has the inherent authority to dismiss patently frivolous claims. I understand there is a focus on Sertain in the ability to, or in the actual procedural history of the plaintiff having.
Is that a material distinguishing fact?
We don't believe so, Your Honor. It's not material in the law. It's not material in the facts of that case. If it were material in the facts of that case, then there would have been a futility analysis in that case. And they found that it would have been futile in general legal in case law to say that there would be leave to amend for patently frivolous claims, because what is there to amend in a frivolous claim? It has no base in law or fact. And in fact, when you're looking at patently frivolous claims from a historical context, there is no case or controversy. There's no subject matter jurisdiction. Now, that's not the analysis the district court did here, but it's an important precursor to the cases that ultimately say there is Article III inherent authority for a district court to dismiss patently frivolous claims. So we don't believe it's a materially distinguishing feature of certain that sets out the rule as preceded by Tazo and Byrne.
But let me play devil's advocate. So let's assume that you have a pro se plaintiff who doesn't understand pleading requirements for fraud. Maybe they're making a fraud misrepresentation claim. A district court judge or a law clerk looks at it and says, this looks patently frivolous, and recommends that the district court judge dismiss as patently frivolous. But if the plaintiff had been given an opportunity to respond, they could have added additional allegations with regards to the fraud.
Your Honor, I have two responses to that. One is that the plaintiff would have the option, as discussed in the Link case by the Supreme Court, to file a post-judgment motion to have the court reconsider it based on some sort of misapplication of the law of frivolity. But there's always, as this court knows, the ability for the plaintiff to bring an appeal saying that it was not frivolous because there were additional allegations that could have been made based on the features of the complaint. I think it would be very case specific as to how that district
court. Right, but I guess my concern is that if we're being asked to write an opinion, it seems to me difficult to do this like sort of bright line rule when I think the better course would be to issue an order to show cause.
I think that the court can write an opinion, as pointed out by the cases in the reply brief, that makes it very clear to district courts that they should consider certain orders to show cause, certain procedural safeguards in these circumstances. I mean, we have cases from the Second Circuit that are cited in the briefing that even after Fitzgerald by the Second Circuit, which recognizes this inherent authority to dismiss without notice, does emphasize how these cases can be difficult or made difficult by a lack of notice. But ultimately, the outcome here would still be the same because there's no dispute here that these claims were frivolous. There's been no appeal that these claims, that the district court reached the wrong finding or as to frivolity or as to the malicious aspect of it because they were successive. He was on notice. He had that notice in this case. So even if the court were to write an opinion that said we strongly encourage notice, we think it is an important feature.
But could the distinguishing fact be here that in this case the plaintiff did have notice already?
Yes.
That I think that could be the distinguishing factor.
Yes, Your Honor, that is certainly a distinguishing factor.
So you think that takes this case out of one, let's assume this was his first complaint, and it was just as frivolous and just as futile as any others because of statute of limitations and heck issues. You're saying there that a court cannot exercise its inherent authority to dismiss under those circumstances?
I think there it would be very dependent on the claims, Your Honor.
The exact same claims we have here with the exact same reasons for dismissal.
Your Honor, I do believe that those could be frivolous as well because the correct frivolity finding could be made because these claims are heck.
In other words, I assume everything I've just said, which is it is just as frivolous as this one is. It is just as futile as this one is. The only fact is this isn't complaint number four. It's complaint number one. You're telling me a court can't exercise its authority. It has to then go through the process of saying, tell me why the turd you sent me is not a turd?
Not under certain, Your Honor. I think under the court's reading of certain, which is correct, there is a rule that allows for that dismissal without notice.
And I think that goes back to what you've just said, which is there actually are Article III issues with frivolous complaints. In other words, you only invoke our jurisdiction if it's case in controversy. And if something is so frivolous it doesn't present a case in controversy, then a court may not even have subject matter jurisdiction to act.
That's
right,
correct, Your Honor. To highlight that point just a little bit, because I understand this was not a dismissal based on subject matter jurisdiction, that is sort of a renowned feature of the case law on this point about dismissal with frivolity. There are cases that recognize the exact inherent authority for a court to dismiss frivolous claims under its Article III power, But then there are the cases that are sort of saddled with that, the Article III question of subject matter jurisdiction. And I think both of those can be read sort of in tandem here, that there is nothing that stops the district court from doing what it's doing. In fact, it probably has an obligation to do that screening. It just doesn't need to do that in the typical course of things, because usually, frankly, the pro se filings that come before the court are typically under the informa pauperis statute, and then it goes through the normal process there of screening. And then the ones that have the filing fee paid, usually there's a summons that's been issued, there's a response by a defendant. This case just has some unique facts to it that the court screened it really based on the prior, my understanding is probably based on its knowledge of the prior frivolous filings. The Fort Myers district is a small one. It's not like it wouldn't have been highlighted for the court that this was something that was going on here.
How would you respond to counsel's argument that, okay, up till now, his allegations have left a lot to be desired, but if he had been given the opportunity to amend, he has some allegations that bring it outside of the statute of limitations problem, talking about continued harassment.
That argument hasn't been raised, Your Honor. It's been abandoned. Okay. There's been no argument raised in the initial brief, and it's sort of suggested in the reply in the case law, but not outright made. It can't even be raised for the first time there, that there was an abuse of discretion for the district court's frivolity finding, which again would be a wide discretion owed to the district court.
In other words, the way this was teed up to us was that assuming the complaint is frivolous, assuming it is futile to amend, these procedures need, our law requires that these procedures need to be there. That's the way this case was teed up to us, right?
Yes, Your Honor, we agree with that fully. The court doesn't have any further questions about the existence of this inherent authority or the notice issue. We submit that in conclusion, this court should confirm a district court's inherent authority to dismiss patently frivolous suits without advance notice and affirm the judgment below.
Thank you. Ms. Satterthwaite, you have 5 minutes left.
So, counsel seems to concede that some safeguards are required, and the scenarios presented to Amicus highlight the confusion in this circuit and the need for a bright line rule. We, of course, are asking for a bright line rule that it should always be noticed and an opportunity to amend.
I appreciate that you appreciate a lot of what you're doing here today, but I appreciate that you want us to clarify the law. I guess my question is, I really tried to dig into this because this is my first area in dealing with this, and it seems to me that we've said at least three times what the bright line rule is. It is, there's a general rule that notice and opportunity to be heard is required, but there's a narrow exception where it's futile or where it is patently frivolous or it would be futile to amend. Why is that not good enough? And I get that there's some unpublished opinions out there that seem to say some other stuff, but why is that not good enough?
Well, as mentioned, in Tazo, it's dicta. In Certain, there were opportunities to amend, and we don't advocate the position that they should be given unlimited opportunities to amend. And then in Byrne, the source of Byrne's footnote is all First Circuit law. And specifically in Byrne, the very first sentence of that footnote is, caution must be exercised. So when you go to the First Circuit, they actually require a higher standard from the district court in order to sua sponte dismiss these types of cases. And as well, in the Second Circuit where they do that, in the Sixth Circuit, and in the Seventh Circuit, all those circuits allow this type of dismissal, but the district court must make higher findings because it's supposed to be an extremely rare.
Is there any court which says that where it is patently frivolous and it's futile to amend, that you can't sua sponte dismiss without notice and opportunity to be heard? Is there any circuit that has said that?
There is no circuit that has said you can't upon the higher finding.
Sure, but no one has said.
No one said we recognize that the district court has inherent authority to control their dockets. All we're saying is under Jefferson, procedural safeguards must be followed. Counsel raised the IFP claims. Those have their own procedural safeguards as part of the statute. And even in this circuit, attorneys are given an opportunity to amend with notice when they file deficient pleadings. This is from Vibe Micro. The court says, in the repleading order, the district court should explain how the offending pleading violates the rule so that the party may properly avoid future issues. And that line of cases also comes from Byrne. And so it's our position that procedural safeguards must be used in situations with attorneys and situations with pro se litigants who should not be held to a higher standard than attorneys. If this court is not inclined to require notice and an opportunity to amend, or as Judge Lagoa suggested, a show cause order, essentially asking why it should not be dismissed, then this court can look to other circuits, specifically the Second and Sixth Circuit, which have a higher standard. We specifically like the Second Circuit, which says that pro se submissions are reviewed with special solicitude and must be construed liberally interpreted to raise the strongest arguments they suggest. So under the opportunity to amend procedural safeguard or under the higher standard procedural safeguard, in either instance, this case needs to be remanded for special findings or to allow amendment, because it's clear that the district court did not give special solicitude.
But I guess my question here, or the concern I have, is because you didn't challenge the finding that it was frivolous, why would we remand it back?
Well, Your Honor, we looked at that and decided that it would provide Mr. Vega more robust relief to make clear this procedural safeguards as well as for future litigants than appealing the district court's order on a cold record, because we agree that Mr. Vega's complaint leaves something to be desired and it would be very difficult for him to get relief on abuse of discretion standard. But here, because we're talking about the scope of the district court's inherent authority to dismiss, it is de novo review, and we're asking for procedural safeguards, not just for Mr. Vega, but for all pro se litigants after him. And so under the opportunity to amend safeguard or under the higher standard safeguard, in either situation, the district court needs to take another look at Mr. Vega's complaint. And if he finds that those allegations that I mentioned are, you know, can't be fleshed out, which we think they can, but we're not arguing that for this purpose, then, you know, he finds what he finds. But under either rule, it needs to be remanded. If you have no further questions, I thank you for your time today.
Thank you both, and thank you, Ms. Satterthwaite. I understand that you were proceeding as pro bono counsel, and we appreciate your service in this case.
Thank you.
And also, Mr. Breslow, thank you for proceeding as well as amicus curiae counsel. We have this case under advisement. Our third case.